Well, this morning we are in a split series. The 9:30 folk are going to be doing Genesis, and the 11:30 here we are doing Deuteronomy. And we're going to do that for about 4 weeks through this autumn period. The season within the Church of England, autumn is often called the season of remembrance. And it marks the end of the church year before we start again in Advent and enter the madness, which is Christmas. And yes, there are indeed 59 sleeps until Christmas. Traditionally, in this season, we have events like All Souls, which perhaps ironically we don't celebrate, All Saints and Remembrance Sunday, which we just heard about. But this year, we'll also be remembering 200 years of the life of this church. By definition, remembering is the act of bringing to mind something from the past. The danger is that this is precisely where it can leave us, stuck in the past, where remembering tends towards reminiscing, a wistful reflection on halcyon days past, when things were better, happier, and more successful than they are today. All of which can have a kind of paralyzing effect, leaving us unable either to confront our present or chalk out our future. And yet more than 20 times in Deuteronomy, Israel is instructed either positively to remember or negatively not to forget. However, in each occasion, the call is not to remember the success of God's people, but to remember what the Lord has said, what the Lord has done. The purpose is therefore not to freeze God's people in a desperate longing for salad days, but to help them live wholeheartedly in the present while anticipating what is still to happen in the future. So this morning we begin at the end of chapter 4 where the first call to remember occurs. It's actually given earlier in the chapter in verse 10. Remember the day you stood before the Lord your God at Horeb when he said to me, assemble the people before me to hear my words. Well, the first thing God asks his people to remember is that day. That day when they first encountered God at Horeb on Mount Sinai, as it's also known. If you've ever watched the movie Groundhog Day, you'll know it's a kind of time loop movie in which someone gets stuck in an endless cycle of wash, rinse, repeat, an ever-repeating day, in the hope that somehow in the next cycle, things will somehow get better. Or to use the words in the movie itself, do you ever have deja vu, Mrs. Lancaster? I don't think so, but I could check with the kitchen. Well, here in Deuteronomy is Israel's Groundhog Day, a clear sense of deja vu, that somehow we have been here before. If you think back to the week before last, this is the story that Charlie told us. He described the book of Hebrews as the song of the Exodus in the New Testament, and Deuteronomy is the song of the Exodus in the Old Testament. So perhaps unsurprisingly, Deuteronomy begins by retelling the Exodus story. So turn me, if you would, back to chapter 1, to page 178. And you'll see that we begin just as we have read that Israel is now standing in the plains of Moab, in the desert, on the far side of the Jordan, beside the Dead Sea. But then immediately there is this very strange side note given to us in verse 2. And it says this, it takes 11 days to go from Horeb to Kadesh Barnea by the Mount Seir road. Interesting, I hear you say. But so what? Well, what Moses is saying to those now standing in the plains of Moab is that originally they were supposed to be in the land of Canaan in just under 2 weeks. Having been rescued from Egypt, avoided capture on the route south through Sinai, and reached Mount Horeb at the bottom of the peninsula, where they were to receive the God's instructions for living successfully in the land. They were just 11 days from entering the land. Next stop, Kadesh Barnea, the gateway to the promised land. Think Manchester, if that's helpful. The gateway to the north. But then verse 3 rather oddly begins with these words. In the 40th year. And so to steal Charlie's idea from 2 weeks ago, in the space of one sentence, we have gone from this 11 days to this 40 years of wandering in which the whole generation of those over the age of 20 have died in the wilderness. And it's now Groundhog Day. Israel is once more poised to enter the land and once more poised to receive the Lord's instructions for living there. Hence the name Deuteronomy, the second presentation of the law. And actually, it's a bit more Groundhog Day than even that name might suggest. For Moses' introduction to the Ten Commandments is not, as the marriage band say, for the second time of asking, but for the third time of asking. If you can remember, Moses had gone to the top of the mountain to receive the first set of commandments. But after 40 days away, the people at the bottom of the mountain, they rebel, they construct a golden calf and worship it as the one who rescued them from Egypt. That is, until Moses in his anger grinds it to dust, dissolves it in water and makes them drink it, and then has to reclimb the mountain to repair the shattered relationship between God and his people, to receive another copy of the law. So what then is Moses asking Israel to remember as he recounts these past events to them? Is it simply the great price they paid for disobedience? Many of us, I'm sure, will have experienced the truth of that in our own lives. We have reaped, or perhaps are now reaping, what we sowed in former days. And the pain of that is, at least in part, a reminder to live differently today. If we break the law will break us, one might say. And more or less, this is the pattern of Israel's life. Something that is repeated at Kadesh Barnea, where they refuse to enter because the spies report that there are big people in the land. But as we have seen, it's not just that they broke the law. It's that they forgot the lawgiver. And what becomes clear is that the law alone will not be sufficient to form these people into a nation that can represent God to the world. I was listening to a podcast last week where Professor John Lennox was asked what he thought the comfort of atheism was, to which he immediately responded, it's that you don't have to confront God. Horeb is a reminder that God's people must confront God, must meet him personally, face to face, just as Moses had done at the burning bush. But while this is every bit a personal encounter, it is also by necessity a mediated encounter, mediated by the mountain they stand before. God is at the top. Moses and the priests are in the middle. The people around the bottom and the hostile nations are ranged all around them. But Horeb will also be the place where the tabernacle is given. And I wonder if you've ever seen that it is effectively the mountain of encounter flipped onto the horizontal. It becomes a portable mountain, a mediation device where God can not only meet with his people, but journey with his people to their final destination, while still keeping a safe space between his holiness and their sinfulness. Okay, well, let's turn back then to chapter 5, to verse 5, and to pick up that encounter with God. Page 184. Moses says this, I stood between the Lord and you, declare to you the word of the Lord, because you were afraid of the fire and did not go up the mountain. Israel has already seen God in action in Egypt. It was a visible demonstration of God's power and his authority over Pharaoh, proof that neither he nor his gods rule in the world, but that the Lord, Yahweh, that he is sovereign over all people. It's a display of God's kingship over all nations. But what we learn in that story is that this demonstration of God's kingship was unpersuasive. It actually hardened the heart of Pharaoh, who would not acknowledge God's rule over him. But interestingly, it appears that it also did the same thing to Israel. Exodus 32 describes the situation this way. I have seen these people, the Lord said to Moses, and they are a stiff-necked people. Obstinate, difficult, forgetful, and ultimately disobedient. Despite witnessing God's rescue in Egypt, and despite having met him face to face in Horeb, their hearts too have been hardened against him. So that, as Numbers puts it, they have not followed me wholeheartedly. Here are a people who were unwilling to listen to what God said, for they stood at a distance. They had not learned to trust him, for they were fearful in his presence. And with stiff necks, they would not follow his instructions to their final destination. You see, Horeb is not simply a case of spiritual amnesia, forgetting somehow that God exists. Rather, it represents a decision to consciously ignore God, to deny him his right to shape their lives, to deny his right to rule. Therefore, in asking God's people to remember that day in Horeb, Moses is not just laying out the price of disobedience, but rather is inviting this new generation stood in Moab to make a different decision today. And that's my second point. We move from remembering that day of disobedience to remembering this day of decision for the Lord. As I was preparing, I came across this photograph. It's of the 75th Ranger Regiment. Now, if you're an American here and served in the Rangers, can we have a hooah? We haven't got one. Oh dear. They're reliving D-Day on the 6th of June, 1944. And clearly the regiment of 1944 is not the regiment of today. And yet somehow it is. part of the army's joining process is an induction into the regiment's traditions, which are presented not as if they are historic, but living. As a ranger today, the moment you pass off the square, the moment you don that berry, you share in the regiments, in their glory, in its privileges, in its values. You are expected to live and indeed die according to its ethos, in continuity with everything that has gone before. The past, therefore, is not simply mere memory, but is actualized in the present, in today's soldier. The photograph makes that very point, that we are you. It's a moment that transcends time, as I stand where you once stood. As you listen to the passage being read, I wonder, did you spot the rather odd grammar in chapter 5 there in verse 2? Have a look at that. The Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. It was not with our ancestors that the Lord made this covenant, but with us, with all of us who are alive here today. Just like the photograph, we have transcended both time and place to bring these people together as one event. Moab has become Horeb, such that when God spoke to them, he was speaking now to us. The previous generation is dead in the wilderness, but the current generation remains God's partner in this everlasting covenant. It is every bit their covenant as those who received it at Sinai. Indeed, the covenant partnership extends much further back, doesn't it? For here, standing before Moses in Horeb, is Jacob, the man who wrestled with God and was renamed Israel. Here is Israel today. Moab's generation stands in absolute continuity with him, just as they stand in absolute contrast to those who failed to enter the land. As one commentator puts it, Israel in all its generations now stands in principle at the point of entry into the land. And actually, there is a very real sense that this generation is the more rightful owner of the words that were spoken by the Lord at Horeb. For they were words intended for those who would enter the land, not for those who wouldn't. So the question before us then is, will this generation grasp what their parents failed to take hold of? Will their remembrance of the past inform their decision in the present? Or will they too stiffen their necks, lose faith, and repeat the failures of the past? And so both the past and the future come together in this moment and rest on their actions today. Today is the day of decision. And so the idea of today becomes a defining time frame throughout the book of Deuteronomy. It's what makes Deuteronomy so contemporary as we assemble before God today and must decide to follow him. So what will make the difference then today if we are not to repeat the mistakes of the past? Well, have a look at chapter 5, verse 1. It says this, Moses summoned all Israel and said, "Hear, Israel, the decrees and laws I declare in your hearing today," literally in your ears today, "learn them and be sure to follow them." Three clear instructions are given to them. They are to hear, to learn, and to follow God's instructions. Notice that these are the reverse of what their ancestors did when they failed to possess the land. First, they must listen to God. I ended last week's service by asking you, had you listened? In part, it was to provide a link to today, but also it seemed to me that many of us are very distracted by our thoughts of all that's happened in the week, by the frustrations of traveling here to church, by the phones that were in people's hands. I mean, I know some of you use a Bible app and some of you take notes on your phones, but consider for a moment how easy it is to become distracted as the notifications keep pinging in, the temptation to look back at those, and therefore not to listen, not to hear in your ears. And then secondly, they are to learn. But they are to do this not just by consuming more information, but rather they are to learn through following, by doing. They are to have a lived experience of God, not a theoretical one. Many of us say something like this, "Oh, Jonathan, I can never remember scripture." Well, maybe it's because we're not putting it into practice. See, in evangelical circles, information is rarely our problem. We have lots of it. But obedience may well be. As someone once said, it's dangerous to learn truth faster than we can live it. And to be clear, that's not a call. That is a call to apply what we know, not to stop learning. Well, that brings me to my third point. The experience of the past and the decision to listen and obey God today is not only the key to entering the land, but the key to living in it each day. The way in is also the way on. Every day is to be another today. If God's people can navigate today successfully, then they can also navigate tomorrow successfully, until one day the promise of the land will be fulfilled in them. Consequently, Moab is not the place to stop and to rest, but it is the place from which to push on and on in a series of never-ending todays. It's another Groundhog Day. The call to remember, therefore, is not the call to look back, but the call to go forward and to take hold of everything that God still has in store for his people. And we get here a little snapshot, a foretaste of that, that this is a real possibility for them, that success rather than failure might be possible. For at the end of chapter 4, we are told that they are in the east of the Jordan, in the land of Sihon, king of the Amorites, and have already taken possession of the land of Og, the king of Bashan. Two nations up north have already been defeated on their journey towards success. But then we also get the warning of danger. For not only is this the land of Sihon and of Og, it is also the valley of Beth Peor, the place where Israel had previously failed, having been seduced into unfaithfulness by local Moabite women and their gods. You see, even in a good place, the danger of forgetting God is never far away. A successful past as Israel, as individuals, as a church even like this one, does not guarantee a successful future. Rather, each day must be another today. Each day, a daily decision to listen, to trust, and to follow God. There is one more sense in which this passage speaks of the future, and it's that this generation will not actually be the ones who will fully realize God's promise. Years of conflict lie ahead before the land will be settled, long after this generation has also passed. And so the words spoken to them today are not just for them, but for all who will follow after them. God's promise and God's instructions outlast every generation that receives them. Again, this is true of us, isn't it? Our plans for this church as part of God's ongoing mission in fulfillment of that promise will ultimately be taken up by those who will follow after us, unless, of course, Christ returns. Perhaps then, unsurprisingly, the command is to remember this story to their children. They are constantly to retell it, to remind themselves of these truths, to intentionally be located in this salvation story. Their story has become our story as we too journey forward year by year. Well, finally, I was going to stop here, actually. But as I wrote, I was reminded of our recent series in Hebrews that points beyond this time frame to a better day. It would take another sermon and a different passage to tease those thoughts out. But let me end with just some words from Hebrews 12 that represent Horeb to us, to the church today. You have not come to a mountain that can be touched and that is burning with fire, to darkness, gloom, and storm. But you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You have come to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant. See to it that you do not refuse him who speaks. In Christ, we assemble around a better mountain to listen to a better word that speaks of a better day. So how much more then that we do not refuse him who speaks, that we do not forget him. As the band comes up, if we got ready to go, let's not forget then that day of disobedience, that we might decide this day to obey and continue each day until Christ, who secured the better day, gives us our inheritance on that final day. Amen.